Coming up, a Catholic bishop divides his city when he expels the teachers' union from the parochial schools.
The right to form a union is really not an absolute right.
How can you not say it's hypocrisy when you say that when they urge other employers to allow their workers to have the right to organize, yet deny it to your own workers?
Also, writer Kathleen Norris back with a new book after a decade of silence.
The last 10 years, I would say, have been really rough.
And part of an evening with Garrison Keillor.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. As President-elect Barack Obama plans for his new administration, religious leaders have been offering advice. Obama called Pope Benedict XVI to thank him for his post-election good wishes. No word on what the two discussed, but separately, the Pope's health minister urged Obama not to follow through with plans to expand federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. Meanwhile, leaders of the National Council of Churches called for Obama to make health care coverage a first priority, and the National Religious Campaign Against Torture asked him to issue an immediate executive order banning U.S.-sponsored torture. Some of the most pointed advice came from the U.S. Catholic bishops who held their annual fall meeting in Baltimore this past week. While the bishops welcomed what they called this moment of historic transition, they also warned Congress and the new administration against pursuing, quote, aggressively pro-abortion policies. The bishops said that would alienate tens of millions of Americans and could be seen as an attack on religious freedom. At the UN, President Bush called on world leaders to embrace religious freedom and adopt democratic reforms.
We strongly encourage nations to understand that religious freedom is the foundation of a healthy and hopeful society. We're not afraid to stand with religious dissidents and believers who practice their faith even where it is unwelcome. And the best ways to safeguard religious freedom is to aid the rise of democracy.
The president spoke at the end of a two-day interfaith summit organized by Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah. Human rights advocates said it was ironic that Saudi Arabia was promoting interfaith relations at the UN while restricting non-Muslim religious expression at home. In Connecticut, same-sex couples celebrated their weddings this past week as the state began recognizing gay marriage. Connecticut becomes the second state after Massachusetts in which gay marriage is allowed. Gay marriage had been legal in California for 5 months before voters rejected it last week. That vote has sparked large and angry demonstrations throughout the country. Thousands of gay rights advocates are protesting the role of many Catholics, evangelicals, and Mormons in getting the ban passed. Religious groups have been following closely a case the U.S. Supreme Court took up this week. The question is whether a city that accepts a monument donated by one private organization must accept and display a monument from any other private group. The case involves the city of Pleasant Grove, Utah, which displays in a city park a monument of the Ten Commandments donated by the Fraternal Order of Eagles. Lawyers for a small Utah church calling itself Summum told the court if Pleasant Grove is going to display the Ten Commandments, it must also display the seven aphorisms of the Summum faith.
This small religion wants to express itself just like the Eagles have been allowed to express themselves for the last 40 years. It's a matter of simple fairness.
Several justices appeared skeptical, including Chief Justice John Roberts, who wondered whether the government might later be compelled to carve any president's likeness into the side of Mount Rushmore. The attorney for Pleasant Grove argued a decision in favor of Summum could have dire consequences.
I think disastrous. I think next to the Vietnam Memorial, you could see a memorial saying that the soldiers got what they deserved.
The case has also focused attention on the Summum faith, which says when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, it was not the Ten Commandments he was holding, but rather Summum's guiding principles, the seven aphorisms. The High Court's decision in the case is not expected before next spring. You can find a link to the Summum's seven aphorisms on our website at pbs.org. Now, a battle in Scranton, Pennsylvania, over whether Catholic school teachers should have their own union. It's been Catholic teaching for more than 100 years that workers should have the right to organize. But the Bishop of Scranton, Joseph Martino, has shut the teachers' union out of his parochial schools, prompting a sharp debate. The rights of teachers versus the mission of the church. Lucky Severson reports.
There was a time when a labor strike like this one against the Catholic Church in Scranton, Pennsylvania, would have been difficult to imagine. The church, after all, has always been the champion of workers' rights. These workers are Catholic school teachers whose union was suddenly shut out of the Scranton diocese.
It's union busting of the worst sort because we're used to union busting in the 21st century, but we're not used to those kind of tactics coming from the Catholic Church. How can you not say it's hypocrisy when you say that when they urge other employers to allow their workers to have the right to organize, yet deny it to your own workers?
The Scranton Diocese had recognized the union, which represents about a third of its teachers, for over 30 years, until Bishop Joseph Martino arrived. He commissioned a study of the dwindling parochial school enrollment. The bishop then consolidated four unionized high schools into one and said it would no longer work with the union. It caused an uproar in Scranton's heavily unionized Catholic community.
Many people do not understand all of the facts, and I think if they saw the kind of rhetoric that I've endured from various sides, they would see that we're beyond the stage of talking at this point. So I have made a decision, and I don't think the word has gotten out yet, but it is final.
The bishop's stance might not have caused such an outcry if not for the church's long record on workers' rights. Over 100 years ago, Pope Leo XIII issued an encyclical supporting workers' rights to a living wage and union protection. In the 1960s, the church defended the farm workers' right to organize. And as late as 1986, U.S. Catholic bishops proclaimed that no one may deny the right to organize without attacking human dignity itself.
It's one thing to champion a farm worker or a textile worker. It seems to change radically when it's your own employees that are trying to unionize.
In fact, since the 1970s, church leaders have attempted, sometimes successfully, to bust Catholic teachers' unions across the country. Brian Benestead teaches theology at the University of Scranton, a Jesuit school. He says there are times when fighting the union is justified.
The right to form a union is really not an absolute right. And I think a bishop, when he would look at a teachers' union, would have to see if that union would at all get in the way of the aim of the school. You know, for example, if the existence of the union would be some kind of an obstacle to maintaining the Catholic identity, you know, or the academic excellence, or even the financial viability of the school.
The union says money was not a big issue, that parochial teachers understand they will earn considerably less than public school teachers.
I told Catholic teachers many times, if they taught for the money, if they were here for the money, I hope their medical plan was good because they needed to have their heads examined.
Joseph Casciano is superintendent of Scranton's Catholic schools. He says money is always an issue, and coming up with more would require increasing tuition, something many parents can't afford. He is concerned that because there is so little money available for salaries, the union would instead demand, for example, that teachers not be required to attend functions like Mass with the students. And that, he says, would sidetrack them from their jobs as ministers of the gospel.
We only want what we've always wanted, and that is that you accept your responsibility as one of the ministers in our church, and we believe we do whatever it takes to fulfill that mission.
To keep people who have a legitimate right to have a say over the conditions of their employment, to keep them from doing that and using as an excuse that they're ministerial, and that's, to me, that's hiding behind religion.
To replace the teachers' union, the bishop created one of his own, representing not only teachers, but all diocesan employees.
These are associations of the administrators and the teachers and the staff people and the aides, and they meet on a regular basis to discuss, you know, everything pertaining to working conditions, benefits, and wages.
They created a company union, which is illegal in every other workplace in America. The only legitimate representation that employees could have is when they decide the method of representation that they want to have with their employer.
Mills was a high school history teacher for 33 years before he was let go, along with other teachers, when the diocese consolidated schools. He was told that other teachers had more seniority.
I was fired from my union activity. There were a lot of teachers who had more seniority than me, but there were also a number of teachers who had lesser seniority than I did.
Kevin thought Mike Mills was probably the best teacher he ever had.
Sharon Hurrigan's son Kevin and her daughter Megan were attending Catholic schools at the time. She says she was shocked when she heard what the diocese had done, because she knew the sacrifices teachers were making even when there was a union.
I saw the teachers that were, you know, sitting in broken chairs and, you know, falling out of them half the time. And they would spend their money on supplies for the classroom. They would take their free time to tutor the kids. And it was just incredibly appalling to me that after all of this time, after, you know, 30 years of this kind of service, that they be treated so shabbily. Just appalling.
Denying the union was not a risky venture, because the diocese knew the law, as it is now, is on its side.
In 1979, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Catholic teachers were not protected by the National Labor Relations Act because they weren't included in it. But when the act was written, the vast majority of Catholic teachers were nuns and priests. Now it's different. Today, 9 out of 10 teachers are lay teachers.
In a last-ditch effort to get union protection under state law, the Pennsylvania House is debating legislation known as House Bill 2626, which is similar to laws already enacted in 3 states. It would force a diocese to bargain collectively with teachers' unions in religious schools of all faiths and allow them to bring grievances to the Pennsylvania Labor Relations Board, a bill the diocese strongly opposes.
If the Catholic schools are required to recognize a union, then you're going to have government, you know, intervening in the school and making decisions about whether the bishop's invocation of doctrine is really genuine.
John Dean is a lawyer and serves on the board of Holy Redeemer High School. He argues that the proposed legislation violates the separation of church and state.
House Bill 2626 would constitute a governmental intrusion into our interest in the continuing stability and religious identity of our children's educational path, and an unconstitutional impingement upon our rights to religious freedom. What concerns me as a parent of Catholic students is that our teachers currently accompany our students to Mass. It is certain that the teachers' union will attempt to negotiate that as a term and condition of employment. I do not want the school system.
That is a lie.
I do not want.
That is a lie.
I do,
what a lie. And whenever you got that information, you were misinformed or lied to.
The legislation will be reintroduced in both houses when the legislative session begins in January. While the union holds out hope, Sharon Horrigan seems to have lost hers.
Has this affected your faith?
Hugely. Yeah. It's very hard for me to say this, and it's scary for me to say it, especially publicly, but I've lost my faith. I really have. And I have to say that given all of the what has gone on in our little town, in our diocese, I admire anyone that can hang on to it.
What do we have to compromise, and where do we have to compromise? It affects the mission of the church. And one of the concerns that was at the forefront was always the mission of the schools, that it truly would be, that our schools would truly be Catholic and that they would do what they are supposed to do, which is an extension of the church itself.
For now, that mission will proceed as dictated by Bishop Martino. An appeal from the union to the Vatican was recently denied, and the bishop's right to go forward without a union was upheld. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
In other news, long simmering tensions over one of Christianity's most holy sites erupted in physical violence. Armenian and Greek Orthodox monks brawled inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is believed by some to be the site of Jesus' tomb. The dispute began as a turf battle. Six ancient Christian denominations divide control of the church and often argue over jurisdiction. Religious scholar and author Andrew Greeley was in critical condition in a Chicago hospital this past week. The 80-year-old Catholic priest suffered a skull fracture in an accident. Greeley has appeared several times on this program. He's written more than 120 books and has donated most of his earnings to charities and educational endeavors. We have a profile today of the poet and writer Kathleen Norris, whose books have won her many admirers, especially among religious believers. After nearly 10 years of literary silence, she has a new book out called Acedia and Me. Acedia, Norris says, is a kind of spiritual gloom that she has endured on and off since she was 15.
It's an ancient word that basically means the inability to care, even to the extent that you can't care, that you don't care anymore. It's a sort of a really drastic, nasty form of indifference.
Norris first became popular in the 90s with a story about her life on the Great Plains, to which she and her husband had moved from New York City. The book was called Dakota. In the Dakotas and then at St. John's Abbey in Minnesota, Norris discovered Benedictine monasteries and the ancient practice of chanting the Psalms. She wrote about monastic life in The Cloister Walk. Next, in Amazing Grace, Norris offered her thoughts on Christian language, and in The Virgin of Bennington, she wrote primarily about poetry. And then nothing more. The books stopped coming. What happened was that Norris had to become a full-time caregiver. Now to her 91-year-old mother in Hawaii, where Norris grew up. Earlier, it was her father who needed care and her sister, and especially her husband, David, who suffered severe mental and physical illness for many years until his death from cancer in 2003.
The last 10 years, I would say, have been really rough, and in some senses, this book is a miracle to me because I was able to finish it at all. There were so many temptations, especially after my husband died, to just give up and say, why write at all? Why bother? Which is the ultimate question with Acedia is, why bother? Why care? Why do anything? All thoughts of writing were sort of shoved to the side for me.
Norris thinks Acedia is different from depression.
If I'm depressed, I tend to know the reasons why. With Acedia, there's no cause. It just sort of pops up. And I might wake up in the morning thinking, oh, this is going to be a good day. And then all of a sudden the thought, no, it won't be. And maybe I shouldn't get out of bed.
Slowly, eventually, Norris managed to get back to her book. On the day it was finally published, she was at the Washington National Cathedral, recalling how hard the process had been.
Coming back to the project always felt like climbing a mountain in a raging hailstorm. On more days than I care to recall, I would settle for reading thrillers or even watching America's Next Top Model marathons.
Norris had learned from the Benedictines that one way to combat the indifference of Acedia was praying the Psalms. Other remedies were physical work, exercise, and baking bread. Perhaps most important for her was accepting her family responsibilities.
one of the reasons I decided that I better not have children is because I really didn't want to be in the role of a caregiver. So it's something that's been imposed on me, and I've really had to learn how to cope with that, how to be patient and loving instead of irritable and impatient. And believe me, it is a struggle, and I don't always make it. To think, if I'm with this person, helping them do this ordinary task like going to the bathroom, that's the most important thing I can be doing with my life at the moment, to convince myself of that every day.
One thing that made Norris want to get the book finished and published was her sense that acedia might be a problem for the whole country.
I realized that acedia was not just a personal problem, but really it's one that we suffer as a society. I think we often adopt that attitude of indifference because we're being asked to care about so much, we just are exhausted.
Ever since she was a schoolgirl, Norris found refuge at Honolulu's main public library, from which she borrows and returns books by the bagful. Meanwhile, she says she's also learned a lot from taking care of others.
A friend asked me after my husband died, well, have you lost your faith? And my gut reaction, my instant response was to say, of course not. I mean, people die. This is what happens. That's not God out to get me. That's just a fact of life, is that people die. So it really, it didn't shake my faith really. It made me feel just more like everyone else in the universe. You know, people you love are going to suffer and die, and you somehow have to learn how to cope with that.
Norris says the opposite of acedia and its most powerful antidote of all is love.
I think part of the struggle just of everyday life is remembering that the love is there. It's a constant. And to wake up in the morning and realize that love is there in the world, it's there in your relationships, if I can do that, that's half the battle.
In Honolulu, Norris continues to take care of her mother. She says acedia remains a part of her, something she just has to live with. She would like to write more poems, she says, or in a perfect world, she'd follow a book on acedia with a comic novel. But she knows very well that the world is not perfect. That's almost all of our program for this week. We have one more story to come with Garrison Keillor. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including more of my interview with Kathleen Norris and an excerpt from her new book, along with additional political coverage on our One Nation page. Join us at pbs.org. And now, finally, excerpts from An Evening with Garrison Keillor. The Bard of Lake Wobegon and a Prairie Home Companion was also at the Washington National Cathedral recently, talking about poetry, singing old hymns, and telling stories about the strict fundamentalists who raised him.
These were people with no money and not much in the way of books, except for the good one, of course, and commentaries on it. And they read their scripture very, very seriously. They departed from all of this, from stone and from carved wood and from images and from gold and silver and vestments. And they met in plain rooms and spoke plainly, as a result of which there were never very many of them. They believed in forgiveness in theory, but... In practice, it was, of course, more difficult. And living in a small town, they knew much too much about you to be merciful sometimes. But they loved the King James. They loved Scripture. They loved old hymns. They wouldn't have belonged in the praise churches today, where people gather in big gymnasiums and they hold their hands up over their heads and they sing what we call 7-Eleven. Songs where you sing seven words 11 times and we had a very strict doctrine. We were forbidden to drink or smoke or play cards or go to movies or to dance or even move in a rhythmic manner. for fear that our carnal impulses would be awakened, though, of course, they were awake and dressed and waiting for the bus to come. But as strict as they were, their salvation was their love of language. Somehow, poetry saved their souls and gave them some mercy and some kindness.
Keeler spoke before the election, saying the country had become fractured. We should remind ourselves, he said, that we are truly one people. So he led his audience in singing something everyone knew.